Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, a program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, I'm going to jump right into this because I'm a man on a mission. I believe we are now in the process of being exposed needlessly and with the greatest of peril to a threat that the Biden administration seems determined to ignore. That would be the threat that we tumbled upon providentially in Reedley, California, end of 2022, as I recall. And most of the year that has elapsed since has been a case study of, the government seemingly looking the other way at the possibility that not only did the Chinese Communist Party have a bio-warfare laboratory secretly operating not too far from a key naval air installation and an awful lot of other Americans, of course, but as an investigation by the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party determined, we have no idea how many more of those labs there may be around the United States. And what makes this particularly terrifying, in my professional judgment, is we also have reason to believe that there are large numbers of Chinese special forces personnel who have been insinuated into the United States in recent months. Again, no thanks to the Biden team for stopping that from happening. To the contrary, they've been facilitating it. And the possibility, and I think you have to take it as a very serious possibility at that, that those special forces personnel might marry up with these weapons of mass destruction creates a potential disaster for our country unprecedented in its history here inside the United States. I'm asking every one of you to join me in urging the chairman of that House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, a very good man by the name of Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, to hold hearings and otherwise to drive the House of Representatives, at a minimum, if not the full Congress of the United States, to hold the Biden administration accountable for this train wreck in the making and to insist that corrective actions be taken at once. For one thing, stop the destruction of the evidence out of Reedley, which is underway now, so we can assess what actually was in that lab. And more to the point, start both ferreting out wherever we can the other labs of this kind, if there are others, as well as those special forces operators that we have reason to believe are here in substantial numbers. We're going to take that brief, and we're going to talk with our friend Gordon Chang about it, among many other subjects. Gordon, of course, as you know, is one of our country's preeminent authorities on the Chinese Communist Party. He has many works, including The Coming Collapse of China, are highly prized, as is his work day in and day out at places like the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek and Epoch Times and more. Gordon is a good man, good friend, a very valued contributor to this program, and I hope you will follow him as I do at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter or X. Gordon, what do you think? Am I wrong about all this? Tell me I'm wrong about all this.
I wish I could tell you you were wrong, but I fear you're right. And here's a number of contextual items. First of all, it is unlikely that there's only one such location. And you would think that the Biden administration would be reaching out to the American public asking for leads. Remember, it was a building inspector who saw something out of place that found the facility in Reedley, California. She saw a garden hose that was connected to a facility that should have been abandoned. So this is a really good case of see something, say something. And because of this great threat, the Biden administration should be telling Americans, find the other locations. One other contextual item, and that is, we've known about the Chinese police station in Chinatown, New York. It was known for quite a long time. Took the FBI forever to shut it down. What's even worse is that the Daily Caller and the New York Post have been reporting that there are at least 7 and perhaps 9 other Chinese police stations still operating in the United States, and there is no move to close them off. So we've got to be extremely concerned about what is at best laxity on the part of the Biden administration and could even be more sinister.
Yeah, well, it's malfeasance, I think it's fair to say, at a minimum now, really, and treachery, possibly, as well. What's driving them, Gordon? You study these matters closely, and not just on the Chinese side, but also U.S. policy. How is it that an administration could be so derelict at again, the very best in its duty?
I don't have a good answer to that, Frank. There are so many things that I can't explain when it comes to not only the border, but also the release of Iranian operatives into the United States, which Biden did as part of that 9/11 deal last year. The list goes
releasing them. He's got them in his administration, for heaven's sakes, including in a senior position at the Defense Department, if you can believe it. It's unbelievable.
State Department and the NSC got pro-Iranian officials. It is just, you know.
Well, Gordon, let me, at the risk of cutting you off, let me just say, there is one explanation, and Occam's razor says, go with the one that best fits the facts. And my hypothesis is, as our colleague and friend Sam Faddis says on this program and elsewhere, Joe Biden is a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. He is doing this, if not under instructions, in accommodation at the minimum of people who run him. And that's not a cheerful thought, especially if we're right that what Xi Jinping may be up to here shortly is a shooting war to compound the damage done by his, well, unrestricted warfare. But if that's not the explanation, I don't have another one, and apparently you don't either. So we ought to work from the proposition that Congress ought to be all over this, and maybe it ought to start with having that as an article of impeachment. Let me switch gears, Gordon, because there's a lot more that I want to talk with you about. The Chinese Communist Party has two very important allies in the sort of South Asia arena. One is Pakistan. It has cultivated the Pakistanis for decades. It has enabled them to get nuclear weapons. It has used them to give other people nuclear weapons, including their friends in North Korea and beyond. Another, relatively recently added to their list of facile states, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, I had thought, as part of this strategic arson that Xi is up to around the world, that he would probably cause the Pakistanis to mix it up a bit with the Indians just to get another distraction going. But I hadn't reckoned that he would countenance or allow, for that matter, two of his proxies, partners, vassals, to go at it with each other. What is going on, as you see it, between Pakistan and Iran at the moment?
Yeah, Islamabad doesn't control Baluchistan, and Iran attacked militants in Baluchistan who have, I think, waging a just fight for independence. But that's another story.
This is a population that is actually on both sides of that border, is it not?
It is.
There's a Baluch community in Iran that gives them fits as well, as I understand it.
And this is a complicated story, but really the reason why this is so important is because it shows that the international system is breaking down. You know, you have Iran, it's, you know, firing missiles into Pakistan, into Syria, into Iraq. Iran thinks it can do anything it wants. That is really a sign that there, you know, the United States is not keeping peace and order throughout the world, and that the bad actors feel they can do what they want. So it's not like
Especially with the backing of the Chinese Communist Party. And that's what both these parties have got. Gordon, I apologize for interrupting you. I want to hear more about what you have to say on this on the other side of a short break. We have to pause for just a moment, and we'll talk with Gordon both about what's going on further on this front, but also what might be coming next on the Korean Peninsula and how that fits into this grand design of Xi Jinping. Stay tuned for that and more right after this.
T This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party was covertly running a laboratory replete with samples of deadly diseases like Ebola in the city of Reedley, California. Congressional investigators believe other such biolabs may still be operating elsewhere in America. You might have expected these revelations would be treated as a first-order national security emergency. After all, a shooting war with communist China is distinctly in prospect, and the possibility that even one such lab might arm thousands of Chinese special forces here is terrifying. Yet, a House committee found the FBI and Centers for Disease Control were astoundingly indifferent to the discovery of this lab and its 20 deadly pathogens. And Fox News reports the Reedley facility's contents are being destroyed without public disclosure about the peril they posed. Congress must compel the Biden administration to counter, not ignore, the CCP biowarfare threat in America. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with one of our favorite guests and one of the most important of our contributors, Gordon Chang. Follow him as I do at Gordon G. Chang, as well as just about any place else you can find him, which is most places, because he is an incredibly, productive contributor to the public policy debate about China and much more. And so, Gordon, I had to cut you off on a point you were making about the vacuum of power that Iran is filling. I think created, again, deliberately, it seems, by the Biden administration, really from the get-go.
Yeah.
Finish that thought.
One can argue that this dispute between Iran and Pakistan isn't important. And I can sort of buy into that. But the point is, it's not just Iran and Pakistan. It is going to be other disputes around the world. You know, you can think of Armenia and Azerbaijan, for instance, which could easily blow up. There are so many of these around the world. And when all of these occur at the same time, then you got to start thinking, is this World War III?
It is World War III, and is it being precipitated by a guy who wants very much to have us especially distracted by the rest of the world conflagrations, which he has been, I would argue, setting a light everywhere. Definitely, I'm glad you mentioned this issue. It's, I think, less the Azerbaijanis than it is the Turks who are making it absolutely clear they're going to do to Armenia what was just done to Nagorno-Karabakh. That's one to watch for sure. But Gordon, let's talk about another place that definitely seems to be reaching the boiling point. Again, I think probably with at least the assent of Xi Jinping, if not at his orders, the Korean Peninsula. Talk about this constitutional amendment that the North Koreans have done, maybe it's a new constitution, I don't know, whatever they call it, it doesn't matter. What matters is the policies that Kim Jong-un is pursuing. And what would you characterize those to be?
Yeah, those policies are important. You have to go back to last month where the Workers' Party held its eighth plenum. Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker, two American academics, actually posted an article on the 38th North site this month saying that Kim Jong-un has made a strategic decision to go to war. Now, that is a fascinating piece. I don't agree with it, but the point they make, which is an important one, and I do agree with, is that Kim Jong-un sees the United States to be in global retreat and that they feel they can do what they want. So here again, you have a vacuum, if you want to call it that, but clearly bad actors thinking that they now have the strategic space to engage in some of the most destructive acts. And when it comes to North Korea, we know that they have not only intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the United States, but they also do have nuclear weapons. We don't know if they've mated them to those missiles. But when you want an EMP device exploded over the United States, you don't need to have good guidance and you don't need to have reentry. So those are two things that people say, oh, don't worry about it. They don't have guidance. They don't have reentry. I really don't care if you're talking about an EMP attack.
Yeah. Electromagnetic pulse is a big problem we focused on very intensively at the Center for Security Policy. If you want to learn more about the implications of that EMP threat, and for that matter, more prosaic means of taking down our electric grid, I encourage you to go to a wonderful coalition the center sponsors, the Secure the Grid Coalition, run by my colleague Tommy Waller. Gordon, let me just ask you before we wrap up on Korea, where do you come down in the debate that we sometimes hear in this country as to whether Xi does in fact control Kim Jong-un, or whether Kim Jong-un is kind of his rogue bastard stepchild, you might say, that he can't actually control, and therefore if something were to go sideways on the Korean Peninsula, it would not be at Xi's direction.
The Chinese, when they want the North Koreans to do something, the North Koreans do it. Now, often the Chinese will just sort of back off and just let the North Koreans be the North Koreans. There's an added wrinkle, and that is that Kim Jong-un is trying to move away from Beijing towards Moscow. We saw that in the September meeting near Vladivostok between Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin. But you've got to remember that China controls Russia in many respects. So China is the one to watch over all this. And by the way, when you think about Kim Jong-un's strategic decision to go to war, the point is the Chinese and the Russians might want to push him into war to create another proxy conflict, because China is fueling proxy conflicts around the world, in Ukraine, North Africa, in the Middle East. One more in East Asia could be something that Xi Jinping finds useful if he wants to attack Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, India. So,
yeah, that's the theory of this show. That's for sure. We're dealing with pyromania. And I think the arsonist in chief is Xi Jinping. Gordon, let me turn finally. I believe it was at Gatestone that you published a piece about how the Taiwan voters, in opting for freedom as opposed to enslavement by the CCP, like their soulmates in Hong Kong were subjected to recently, has cut Xi down to size, I think was the headline. Explain that, if you would, and how does that jive with what we've just been discussing?
Well, here you have 23.5 million people who live barely 100 miles away from this menacing, huge state, and they completely just disregarded what the Chinese were saying. They defied Xi Jinping. And Xi Jinping, whose main form of diplomacy is intimidation, well, these people were not intimidated. So we have to ask the question, why is Joe Biden, who's the head of the world's most powerful state, the most powerful state in history, why is he intimidated by Xi Jinping when we're divided by the world's biggest ocean?
Well, we've just addressed one theory of the case. He's working for him. Whether that's the explanation or another, Gordon, the thing that's indisputable is he is, at every turn, it seems, submitting to the Chinese Communist Party. And so whatever the motivation, the implications for our country are very, very grim indeed. And we just did a program of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. I was hoping you might be able to join us, but you are so oversubscribed that we're lucky to get you on here, and I'm very grateful for that. But it was a very interesting program. It was about the Committee on the Present Danger, China webinar series about what the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare is about, the help they're getting from captured elites, and the prospects now of a shooting war. And the thesis was that what we're dealing with is really a Biden doctrine that has as its sort of unifying quality, no worse friend, no better enemy. And that really seems to me to be kind of the leitmotif of this operation. Again, set aside for the moment the motivations, but how would you characterize the accuracy of that depiction, sir?
Well, certainly. I mean, you look at the Middle East. When President Trump left office, we had very good relations throughout the Middle East, except, of course, with the enemy Iran. Biden, when he campaigned for the presidency, said he was going to make the House of Saud a pariah over the murder of Khashoggi. And what has happened is Biden has turned his back on our traditional friends in the Gulf. He's embraced Iran. and he's created a disaster in the Middle East. Remember, Trump with the Abraham Accords had the most successful American foreign policy in the Middle East since FDR, who stitched up the relationship with Riyadh. We are seeing one catastrophe after another because of Biden's policies. You know,
you've mentioned several times, including just now in passing, and we have to have you back to talk about it in greater detail, North Africa as another place in which this policy is going very badly. And I think, again, we see Xi's hand at work. Gordon, as always, we have too little time to talk about too many topics, but thank you for covering so many of them so well today. And we look forward to our visit with you, hopefully next week. In the meantime, keep up the tremendous work you do at the Gatestone Institute and in all of your other outlets and platforms. And keep coming back to us, if you would, sir. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this short break. Please stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're going to have a very important conversation with one of my friends, as well as one of my most valued colleagues at our Center for Security Policy. His name is Dr. David Wormser, no stranger to this program. He's one of our go-to guys on the Middle East. He runs the Center's Middle East Project and is deeply experienced and knowledgeable, combining not only a background in naval intelligence, but also service as an aide to an undersecretary of state, a national security advisor, and not least the vice president of the United States. Dr. Wormser, it's good to have you back with us. Welcome once again.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Frank. Thanks.
Thank you. A lot to talk about, not a lot of time to do it, David. I did want to sort of catch up on a couple of things that are important to the Middle East portfolio that you manage for us so well at the center. Just for starters, earlier in the program, Sam Faddis mentioned that an IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, representative basically said at the Davos World Economic Forum summit that Iran is no longer a threshold nation, meaning that it has all the capabilities, but it just hasn't put them together. But he now says that they seem to have gotten past that point. They have nuclear weapons, presumably, is his not-so-subtle message, as well as he thought that may have something to do with the new heightened aggressiveness of not just Iran's proxies, but Iran itself. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, certainly I think Iran is moving ahead. We had the IAEA yesterday, the head Grossi, say that they have now amassed enough HEU, highly enriched uranium, for multiple warheads, six, I believe, is the number generally assumed. every single time Iran lurches ahead in its nuclear program, it is accompanied by regional aggression. In 2006, when they trashed the Paris Agreement, which froze their program, we knew that it was frozen, the freezing was unfrozen, and that they were moving ahead by launching the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel. So there's a consistent pattern. Whenever Iran unleashes its proxies, you should immediately look at their nuclear program, because that is where it's usually a diversion for that. Now, we had other things too, the Saudi Arabian-Israeli peace progress, not process, it's not a process, it's progress, as well as a regional alliance essentially emerging against Iran. And certainly they wanted to derail that. But from day one, from October 7th in the morning, this was my concern, that Iran would lurch ahead with the nuclear program.
And David, I guess I wanted to ask you about some of the aspects of that heightened aggression. Is there any doubt in your mind? I've heard it said, even with all that has come out since October 7th, that Iran may not have known about that attack. What's your thought on that, sir?
Did it know the exact time and minute it was going to be launched? That's hard to say. We don't know. One thing we do know is that they built the program that did this attack on October 7th. They were the ones who trained the various terrorists. We know they were trained in Mashhad. This was what was intended. Whether it was intended to be on that day at that time, I don't know. But this is what they intended. So I don't think the timing, it's sort of, if a murderer buys a weapon and he goes to the bank, you don't know if that was the time he was scoping it or actually robbing the bank, but that's what he intended. So I don't think we should twist ourselves too much up with Iran's intent. They were behind it.
Yeah. And I personally believe that they were informed.
I think
to the moment.
I can't imagine they didn't know.
It seems incredible. David, this brings me to the Houthis. The Biden administration, on its first couple of days in office, as I recall, as a sop to the Iranians, act of appeasement, I would argue, took the Houthis off the designated terrorist list. They have now put them back on the designated terrorist list. Was there anything that transpired in the run-up to the Biden presidency, after the Biden presidency began, up to the present moment, that was anything other than that of a terrorist organization? And if they're now recognized as such again, I guess that's a good thing. But how much do you think it might have contributed to what's happened most recently, that they went through this kind of rehabilitation and you know, obviously increased abilities of Iran to facilitate their terror?
Well, I think taking the Houthis off the terrorism list was part of a larger, first of all, your first part of the question, did the Houthis do anything essentially to change their behavior to warrant being taken off the list? That now they're doing again the warrant putting it back on. The truth is they never changed any behavior. They've been a terrorist organization full tilt all the way through. But why would the administration do it? I think what we see is that the administration came in with a preconception unrelated to events on the ground, that it will seek a regional peace agreement essentially with the Iranians, a JCPOA, an Iran nuclear deal, but a much larger one, JCPOA 2.0, which includes a regional arrangement strategically with the Iranians. So what they did was, whether it's the maritime agreement with Lebanon, or it's the taking the Houthis off the terrorism list, the ignoring of sanctions being applied, the lifting or unfreezing of assets of Iran, even the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think everything points in one direction, which is the United States was offering Iran a strategic retreat in exchange for Iran's cooperation in managing and stabilizing the region. So all these things, the Houthi being taken off the terrorist list, was all part of our strategic retreat, which was the cost we were willing to pay for our ideology or our really delusional policy that somehow we can come to a regional arrangement with Iran that stabilizes the region.
Right. So just bottom line, would it be fair to say that that has emboldened not only the Iranians, but the Houthis and, for that matter, the other Iranian proxies to believe that this was a contemptible vacuum of power that was being created by the United States disengagement and to be exploited by them at will?
Oh, absolutely. They couldn't believe their good luck, so they had to test it. So the first thing they do to test it is to blow through the 3.9% or whatever, 3.7% enrichment limit they were under and basically start trashing the entirety of their obligations under the nuclear JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. By the way, one thing they said is, well, America withdrew. Iran was given this agreement because it had violated the NPT. It was a special sweetheart deal. Yeah, it was a sweetheart deal given the Iranians to bring them back into compliance by saying this amount of cheating we're just going to now validate. You can continue cheating, but don't cheat further. So if Iran walks out of the deal, the sweetheart deal is off the table, and then they are obliged to follow all the restrictions every other normal country in the world follows under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which means they have to go back to no enrichment, no advanced nuclear program, et cetera, no dual use. So Iran is being disingenuous, and its defenders in the United States, of which there are many, are also being mendacious on this issue.
Yeah, that's for sure. David, among those are, of course, the Biden administration personnel who have been trying to engineer this rapprochement or appeasement policy, whatever you want to call it. One of whom is a chap I had not, frankly, heard of before by the name of Abram Paley, who apparently is now, I guess, running this envoy to Iran portfolio since his boss, Rob Malley, has been sidelined due to serious security breaches, apparently. I heard an interview with him the other day and frankly was just gobsmacked by the nonsense that was coming out of his mouth about how clear we've been with the Iranians and how, you know, we're shocked that they're engaging in terrorism and that, the diplomacy and the international community that's come together behind all of this is so important and all the rest of it. And the bottom line, it seems, is whether it's with respect to Iran or whether it's respect to taking down Benjamin Netanyahu, which our friend and colleague, our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, Carolyn Glick, has just written about as a part of this Biden policy towards the region. It's misbegotten in the extreme, and it is making it, the region, and the world a vastly more dangerous place. Would you agree?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. We're getting in a big fight with our best ally in the region, Israel, by trying to oust its government because we believe its government is the real obstacle to the successful and happy application of our grand regional scheme. But the truth is that grand regional scheme, and Paley is a good example of what he says, is a good example of it, is smoldering. It's in ruins. It has failed in every single corner. It is part of a larger global failure, whether it's with the Ukrainians before February 22, or frankly, what we're seeing with North Korea, China merge, and so forth. This immense weakness is leading to a spectacular collapse. And we're angry at the symbol of why at Israel, because it shows the collapse.
We did a special program of our Committee on the Present Danger China this week in which we talked about, treating our friends worse than our enemies. And this is a formula for disaster. Many worse enemies, more emboldened, fewer friends. David Wormser, we have to leave it at that. Come back to us with more, if you would, please, in the near future. Thank you. God bless you. We'll be right back with a dedicated segment on saving persecuted Christians. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party was covertly running a laboratory replete with samples of deadly diseases like Ebola in the city of Reedley, California. Congressional investigators believe other such biolabs may still be operating elsewhere in America. You might have expected these revelations would be treated as a first-order national security emergency. After all, a shooting war with communist China is distinctly in prospect, and the possibility that even one such lab might arm thousands of Chinese special forces here is terrifying. Yet, a House committee found the FBI and Centers for Disease Control were astoundingly indifferent to the discovery of this lab and its 20 deadly pathogens. And Fox News reports the Reedley facility's contents are being destroyed without public disclosure about the peril they posed. Congress must compel the Biden administration to counter, not ignore, the CCP biowarfare threat in America. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say welcome always to our next guest. His name is Robert Spencer. He is, I believe, our country's preeminent non-Muslim expert on Islam. He has written, I think it's 27 books, but don't hold me to that because it keeps changing day by day. The latest one of which is a fabulous treatise on the Byzantine Empire. He calls it Empire of God. And it is a very interesting insight into how Western civilization was saved by this Byzantine Empire that, you know, brought us to, our present moment by preserving the best of Judeo-Christian and especially Greco-Roman civilization. We're going to talk a little bit about uncivilization and the outfit that has been threatening the Western world, the Judeo-Christian civilization, for, well, whatever it's been now, 1,500 years, something like that, Robert. The Empire of Islam in its various incarnations. And we were just talking with Peter McIlvaine about a subject that I know you've touched on recently in your reporting at jihadwatch.org, namely, this Rotherham investigation and its findings about what was going on in a British city, Manchester, that is just unspeakably awful, but unfortunately all too characteristic of how women are treated in general, but particularly Christian women like those of the Middle United Kingdom. Talk us through your take on that, Robert, and its implications beyond Manchester.
Well, it's noteworthy, Frank, that just recently I was stunned to see in The Guardian, the far left paper in Britain, the first acknowledgement that I can remember ever seeing in an establishment media source that the rape of captives, they were speaking specifically about Hamas raping captive Israeli women, is sanctioned in Islamic jurisprudence. But it is a fact. Here again, of course, we have to say that not all Muslims subscribe to this, but nonetheless, the jihadis do. And that's why they have behaved this way, not just in Britain, but also in regard to Israel, as well as in Nigeria and in the ISIS domains and elsewhere. And so these British girls were subjected to this on a massive scale because their captors and rapists thought that they were doing something that was actually pleasing to God and had divine sanction. The British authorities, meanwhile, were terrified of being called Islamophobic and racist. And so they let it go and let it happen for years and did not confront, knowing very well that it was happening. And dismissing it, people would come to them with complaints and they would say, well, you know, this girl, she's really not a very straight-laced girl. And they would put the blame on the victims. And as a matter of fact, there's still people in Rotherham who are saying it's still going on and the same phenomenon is still happening. The British authorities are terrified of the Muslim population and that keeps them from acting.
Yeah. I'm told that the investigation itself indicates that 96 men are still, as you say, at risk of this, if not actively engaged in it. And again, this is a shock on so many different levels, and to be abhorred and obviously terminated as well. Robert, unfortunately, the jihadis of whom you were speaking a moment ago are not just raping Israeli women. They're threatening to do October 7th again and again and again if they get their chance. And yet the Biden administration is intent on entrusting a state in the Holy Land to, if not exactly those people, others who seemingly share their Sharia supremacism. Talk us through this idea that there is a Palestinian state at the end of this very difficult war with Hamas, and whether Bibi Netanyahu, who has now categorically rejected that idea, is in the right.
Well, it's really kind of ridiculous that the Biden administration would be saying at this point that what we need to do after all this is reward the Palestinians by giving them a state. Also, they have completely refused to recognize the fact that the Palestinians have rejected multiple offers for a state going back to 1947, that the condition for all of those was that they would recognize Israel as a Jewish state and live side by side in peace with the Israelis, which they will not do because, as they're frequently chanting these days, they want the whole thing from the river, the Jordan River, to the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and that means the total destruction of Israel. Islam commands this in saying that any land that was ruled by Muslims at any point belongs to them forever. Their Palestinian leadership has made it abundantly clear in all the different groups that they all subscribe to this. And so Blinken is chasing a pipe dream that could be extraordinarily damaging.
Yeah. And Robert, as you know so well, this idea of Israel engaging in genocide against the Palestinians is, of course, belied by precisely the motivation that you've just talked about, which brought this war about in the first place. Hamas has got it in its charter that it's going to destroy the Jewish state, does it not?
Yeah, there have been open calls for genocide from numerous Hamas leaders and other Palestinian leaders. We had, what's his name, Hamad recently say that there's going to be October 7th, there's going to be more October, October this, October that, October 1 millionth. And until this is going to go on until Israel is completely obliterated, which of course would mean the murders of millions of Israelis. So that's where there's genocide. Meanwhile, the population in Gaza and the Palestinian population in general has grown steadily over the years, which means that the Israelis, if they're carrying out a genocide, they're doing it very poorly.
Very poorly, and certainly not with the weapons they have at their disposal to do it very efficiently, and to spare in the process their own personnel, who are now taking significant casualties given the small size of this population of Israel. We have to take a short break, Robert. When we come back, I want to put this into a larger context of this combination of just the various elements that have come together to wage this genocidal war against Israel. I'll be right back with that with Robert Spencer right after this. We're back. Robert Spencer is in the house, I'm very pleased to say. We're visiting with him about this phenomenon of the jihad. And he is the author of numerous books on the subject of jihad and the Sharia law that impels its followers to engage in it. The jihad specifically against Israel, but also really against Western civilization more broadly, something that's baked into Islamic law, Sharia, the code, they call it. And Robert, I so appreciated your clarity about you know, the nature of Hamas and its objectives. I'm interested in following this up on two fronts, one here at home and the other with respect to Iran. Here at home, the Palestinian franchise of the Muslim Brotherhood is pulled in, of course, the very considerable support of the mothership, but also of Marxists who have seemingly thrown in lock, stock, and barrel, even queers for Palestine, no less. What is up with that, Robert? What is the point of, you know, convergence in which these two rather different ideologies nonetheless find a way to make common cause?
Well, the leftists are collectivists. Every leftist state, every far left entity that we have ever seen in the world, going back to the French Revolution, wants to erase individual differences and put everybody on the same level. And so the most extreme example of that was communist China under Mao, where everybody even wore the same clothes, because even if we had different clothes, then that introduces inequity. And so to follow through on equity, which is a word we hear a lot from the Biden administration, erase all differences between people. And now Israel is a state that is openly based on ethnicity, it's a Jewish state. And so it is a thorn in the side of the collectivists. And it's kind of paradoxical because, of course, most Jews in America are leftists, but I think they haven't thought it through, that leftism is inherently against the people who have refused to join the collective and maintained their own traditions all around the world throughout history.
Well, this brings us to Iran, which has a lot of history, of course. Some of it pre-Islamic, of course. Some of it what has been impelled by Sharia and its teachings. Talk to us a little bit, Robert, about the aggression that Iran has been engaging in of late, most obviously through proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah and now the Houthis, but in its own right to some extent as well, 100-plus attacks against American bases and personnel scattered around Syria and Iraq. And whether you think an explanation for why this is happening is not just the weakness of the Biden administration, its relentless determination to try to appease the Iranians, but also, as was suggested by an International Atomic Energy Agency speaker at the World Economic Forum program in Davos, this new aggressiveness is a product of Iran having moved past the status of a threshold nuclear weapon state to actually being one that has the bomb. I don't know if you care to comment on that or not, but that may be the context of what's happening here, and I'm anxious to get your thoughts on it.
Frank, it's certainly within the realm of possibility that Iran has the bomb now. They've been working toward it for many years. And just recently, on the other hand, I have seen it reiterated that the Ayatollah Khamenei has issued a fatwa saying that the nuclear bomb is un-Islamic, with all kinds of assurances that the Islamic Republic is not actually pursuing a nuclear weapon. And people take this seriously, and they, of course, refuse to look at the fact that this is a Shiite regime, and it was Shiite Islam that actually developed and made central the idea of taqiyya, of dissimulation on a large scale, in order to lull the enemy into complacency. And so I think it's naive in the extreme, willfully ignorant, not to assume that the Iranian regime is lying to us pretty much all the time. And so I think it's entirely within the realm of possibility that they have the bomb now, but also it cannot be underestimated. It's not just the weakness of the Biden administration, but the mullahs know that the Biden administration is on their side. And I'm not overstating that. After October 7th, Biden sent them $10 billion after October 7th. That, as far as I'm concerned, is a criminal act, a treasonous act. But of course, nobody batted an eye. Nobody seems to care. But the Iranians, imagine how they would think. If your mortal enemy, who you've been crying death to America for years, and then they send you $10 billion, you're not just going to think they're weak, but you're going to think they are no threat at all. They want us to succeed. And so we can just act now with impunity.
I heard an individual, I believe it was with the Atlantic Council, arguing the other day that the Iranians might not have known about the attack on Israel. Do you credit that as a possibility?
I think that's extraordinarily unlikely. The Iranians finance Hamas. So for Hamas to plan for 2 years, as they themselves have said, this massive attack without letting their benefactors know, that strains credulity beyond the big.
Yeah, and I think there's actually records of meetings that took place between Hamas operatives and the Iranians at various points in Lebanon, I think, particularly. One other question, Robert. The Biden administration has just this week decided that the Houthis actually are terrorists, after all, having right out of the gate when Biden came to office, as one of their first acts of abasement and appeasement of Iran, remove them from the designated terrorist list. Do they belong there? And doesn't Iran as well?
Yes, of course, both do. And it's just another manifestation of the incoherence of the administration that the Houthis are terrorists now when they weren't before, and the Iranians aren't.
Yeah, and this is a fraud, and it's going to get people killed, large numbers of them, unfortunately, I'm fearful. Robert, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time, my friend, the great work you do at jihadwatch.org, and as a fellow of our Center for Security Policy, God bless you. We'll talk again soon. Thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. Come back for next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.